trying to live right, trying to eat right. What? I got something to say, let me talk. You either feel me or you not.
Welcome to The Future of Policing in Columbus. I'm Edie Driscoll, your host for today's episode. We'll be talking about consent decrees, not something that many of us walk around knowing much about. We don't have one right now in Columbus, but there are folks here who would like to see one happen. So we're going to find out today where we are in that process and what needs to happen next. The Columbus Division of Police has had brushes with federal oversight since the 1970s. After a lawsuit filed by a group of black officers resulted in a judgment in 1985 that required them to behave in a more equitable manner, they changed many of their policies and then began backsliding into practices that discriminated against black citizens and their own black employees. By the late 1990s, the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit that would impose a consent decree on the police, but the city's mayor, city attorney, safety director, and police chief at the time, all of whom were black, fought the action and promised reforms under their own supervision. The Department of Justice went away. In the last year, local activist groups, including Faith in Public Life and the Police Accountability Project, have been advocating for a consent decree to manage the cultural transformation they say is necessary. This is a tough topic, so I reached out to three experts who will help us understand it from three perspectives. Dr. Alan Joe is a leading researcher on the topic. Attorney Sean Walton works daily to lobby for federal oversight. The Reverend Dr. Susan Smith, a seasoned advocate for justice, will help us understand the underlying need for this oversight. Dr. Smith is the founder of Crazy Faith Ministry in Columbus, Ohio. After being the pastor of a church for over 20 years, she now focuses on social justice work and ministers to those who don't want to go into a church. She begins our conversation today as a clergy member of Faith in Public Life, a group of clergy who have been publicly advocating for a consent decree. I asked her to help us understand where this cry for a consent decree is coming from.
Well, you know, I have been thinking about this for a long time, not in direct relationship to a consent decree, but in terms of what we're asking. The police culture is one that is formed in a belief in using violence. Certainly it was the case in this country when people were deputized to, you know, find black people who were enslaved, who were trying to get away. That's the culture. That's the seed from which policing in America has sprung. So we have that element. But we also have all these other parts of the justice system, which all work in cahoots with each other. So that's why there's no accountability, which is that these people on police forces do shoot and kill people, then they get away with it. The justice system is set up so that all of this works like a symphony. It's in harmony. This is what the police do. You have a grand jury, the grand jury, that's a police officer, the police officers go back to where they were. If there's a trial, you know, it's not really, you don't try a whole lot of them for murder. So what happens is there's a settlement, taxes are used to give these settlements, and the family goes away with some money, but their loved one is gone. And I look at this and I think something is wrong with the system. Governing bodies make these laws, which just makes it impossible for there to be justice for people who are attacked, basically, by police officers. And I believe in my heart that they do it just because they can. I'm reminded right now as I'm talking to you of this woman who participated in the January 6th insurrection, and she said, you know, she flew in on her private plane, and she is convinced that she's not going to get arrested. And she said the reason that why is because I'm white and I'm blonde. And I'm thinking, that right there is at the heart of so much of what I see, that African Americans, people of color, are criminalized, and there's a thought process that goes in front of police officers that these are bad people and we have to get rid of them and we can shoot them, and all we have to do is say that we were in fear for our lives and we'll be off the hook. And that is a pattern. So a consent decree where some of this violence is stopped and some of the use of military-grade weapons is stopped, and the police officers are treating specifically African-Americans, but other people of color and different religions are treating them like they're not human and that they are bona fide, you know, before you even ask about it, criminals, and that's just not right. They're not going to change on their own because it's the culture. This is a police culture which has been fine-tuned over hundreds of years, and without some type of intervention to curb the killing of unarmed people and throwing people in prison for minor things while letting some people off of other races who have done far worse things, it's just got to stop. And I don't see that there's any other way other than federal government intervention. I don't see that there's any other way.
With Dr. Smith's insight in mind, I turn to Dr. Alan Zhao, a professor of criminal justice specializing in policing at Rowan University in New Jersey. I caught up with him while on sabbatical last semester as he compiled auditing data from every consent decree over the last 20 plus years. That research, when completed, will be the first ever glimpse at the effectiveness of the use of consent decrees to improve policing in the U.S. Professor Zhao, thank you so much for being with me today. This is a topic that folks in Columbus are very interested in. I'm thinking that we might want to start with some insight into the Violent Crime Act of 1994 and how it restructured the regulation of police behavior in the U.S. Can you start us out with that?
Yes, the 1994 crime bill was usually known as a bill for community-oriented policing for the purpose of fighting and reducing crime. The part that's often ignored is the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice actually instituted a program called the Federal Consent Decree, which is used to make sure that the local police departments are in compliance with constitutional requirements and federal laws. So that's basically where the consent decree actually was born from the 1994 crime bill.
So in 1999, a couple years after that, the Department of Justice attempted to come into Columbus, Ohio, and supervise our police department by using one of these consent decrees. The leadership at the time, including the mayor, the police chief, the safety director, essentially struck a deal with the Department of Justice, promising the reforms that they were looking for. And so we never did have a consent decree in Columbus. Can you help us understand how that would have worked if they had done that at the time? And maybe a little bit about how does the Department of Justice choose which cities that they want to work with?
Yes, it's often looked at in various cities. It doesn't always lead to a consent decree. I'm not familiar with the details of what the situation was in 1999 in Columbus, but my guess is that the situation was not, it didn't rise up to the what they call the pattern and practice violation, which is systemic. Not just the targeting individual officer misconduct behavior, but the entire police department is systematically in non-compliance with constitutional policing requirements. So if there were a consent decree at that time, it would be a very long-term endeavor between the federal government, specifically the Department of Justice and the City of Columbus, to actually reach an agreement first, and through negotiation, and reach a consent decree, and then have a federal monitor, federal judge actually approve the consent decree, and then the federal judge will appoint a monitor to monitor the progress and implementation, which is extremely arduous and costly, resource-intensive effort. It's not something that that can be done with a light heart. We require a lot of commitment, a lot of loose ends coming together. Politicians, law enforcement leadership, rank and file, members of the community, you know, all have to come together. It's a very long-term effort. It could last 5 years, could last even 10 years.
Interesting. So around the same time, one of our sister cities here in the Midwest, Pittsburgh, did have a consent decree. And
yes.
In 2005, the Vera Institute conducted a review of that consent decree. And at that point, that report that the Vera Institute issued appeared hopeful that this approach would make lasting change. But then we learned 10 years later in a study of Pittsburgh and Cincinnati, another Ohio mm-hmm. city, and Washington, D.C., there were questions about whether those changes were sustained past the period of federal oversight. And then in 2017, another set of researchers reached similar mm-hmm. conclusions. Can you take us through some of that research and help us understand what those researchers found?
Yes, the Pittsburgh actually was the first consent decree ever done. In the history of federal involvement in doing this consent decree, Pittsburgh was always mentioned because it's the number one, it's the first one in 1997. It was a year that the consent decree was signed. As you said, there was an evaluation of the Pittsburgh consent decree, probably by several different researchers. And the basic idea is that it's complicated, but basically it's positive. It demonstrates that the civilian complaints review process improved. The process became more efficient. And that's basically the number one positive finding from the evaluation. And then after that, we have other assessment of consent decrees, like in cities like Washington, D.C., Cincinnati, as you mentioned, Ohio, Detroit, Prince George. The evaluation of those places suggests also that some positive results in the area of training and policies established to create organizational change in reducing police misconduct and to make the police more efficient and effective. The empirical evidence is very rare in this area. There are only a handful of studies. Another study following that also indicate that consent decrees were effective in reducing police misconduct. Personally, myself was involved with the study of the Los Angeles Police Department consent decree, and that evaluation was also positive, showing basically that the reform had led to increased public satisfaction, decreased frequency in the use of force incidents, improved quality of stops and arrests, and the significant organizational and operational changes in the LAPD. So those are basically roughly the few studies actually that have been completed. As I said, it's very rare, and this is one blank area. It's a lot of information, but yet to be examined at a wider scale.
So during Trump's presidency, Attorney Merrick Garland reduced the use of this approach dramatically, I understand. Do we have any information on what impact that decision has had on policing?
Yes, this program is obviously was viewed by the Trump administration as one of the liberal program. People in the business in studying policing and even including police leadership, they don't view it as partisan. It's the purpose is to fight and reduce crime and to make the police more effective, So by reducing police misconduct so they can be more supported by the community, so they can be more effective. So it really shouldn't be a partisan, viewed as a partisan program. So the Trump administration, basically after the first Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, was basically instructed by Trump to curtail, eventually basically kind of completely stop the use of the consent decree during his four-year presidency. So so now we have a Democrat in the White House. So make it look like a partisan. It's really not. It's really to make the police more professional and make them more effective. It's in the interest of all citizens. So I think the impact obviously is very complicated. You know, during the Trump administration, there are all these protests against police brutality, and some people even call for defunding the police. So a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of confusion, and this one was just became politicized as many other things during the Trump administration. So which really shouldn't be treated as I said, as partisan. And unfortunately, it was. I personally believe it was misunderstood by the Trump administration. And so the policy of curtailing the use of consent decree was misguided.
And you feel there's no data that actually says what impact that's had yet. I mean, it's pretty recent, right? That to know if that contributed to any additional inefficiencies within policing.
Yeah, there's no data on the impact of the Trump administration. Obviously, the direct impact, nothing was done. You know, there were no consent decrees down under the Trump presidency. So if they were not down, you can't even evaluate. So it's basically those who were monitored previously, they will simply continue the consent decree reached before the Trump administration, because many consent decrees were still in place. They were all under review by Jeff Sessions, Department of Justice program. They simply continue. Some state actually, including Illinois, picked up the consent decree on its own since Trump administration was not doing anything about it. So create a new kind of a consent decree at a state level, which is kind of innovative, but the idea is essentially the same. If the federal government is not involved, state can still do something about it. The impact is not studied, and all we know is that's not done. You know, the police during the time were pretty demoralized, and a lot of issues going on. You know, COVID and protests, the specific impact of what happened to consent decree obviously has not been studied.
That makes sense. Thanks for clarifying that. So in 2021, this year, you published a comprehensive examination of the entire concept. Tell us more about what you were looking for in that research and what you found and what's next for you in your research on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was doing this because I realized there was a lot of confusion about consent decree. Obviously, there are people who, like our previous administration, believe that there were already too many consent decrees, and they tie the hands of the police. They are too costly, and so they only saw the negative aspect of it. And the other side of the debate was these are very promising programs that can help police achieve better accountability and higher performance. So because of the confusion, I wanted to do a review to see what do we know about it. And my review's purpose is to really better understand this whole concept. And what I have found basically was, I think, meaningful findings from this review was that there were some issues that we need to really pay attention to make the consent decree really work. And a lot of people don't know how involved this program really is. And so my research is basically to develop those understanding, those few areas that need to be addressed very carefully, very clearly. And then my future research, basically in a nutshell, this is what I think need to be addressed. The terms of the consent decree need to be very carefully developed. That's number one. It's got to be very clear. When you have a consent decree, it's like a legal contract. It need to be very specific, very clear. Second, need to be very careful in who to appoint as the independent federal monitor. That monitor is the overarching figure in this whole process. Extremely important position. And thirdly, the leadership and management of the police department and how they institutionalize policies and practices, extremely important. And and including addressing the change of culture in the police department. And lastly, is this audit function, which is really the nitty-gritty detail of this entire consent decree, going to hinge on that, which hardly anybody understands. The auditing function, extremely important to make sure everything is implemented correctly and is eventually measured as in compliance or not in compliance. So those are basically what I try to address in my review in researching this area. And right now I'm doing more studies on police auditing. Actually, I did write a book about police auditing, which not really written about consent decree. But now we know auditing is eventually the core of this consent decree. That got to be in there. Without audit, we don't know what's going to happen to the consent decree.
That makes sense. And that ties back into all that earlier research was saying, that looks like there might be promising, but we don't know how they may play out after the supervision is removed. So that makes tremendous amount of sense.
What else is important for our community to know as they consider asking the Department of Justice for a consent decree? What haven't we covered yet?
I'd just like to remind people that this is an area that's it's very different from all the other reform previously. You know, most police reform previously involve sometimes a government-appointed commission. We have civilian review. We have progressive police leaders who internally drive some reform efforts. One thing that people need to understand is that all these previous reform efforts don't seem to last very long. One reason is they come and go with the people that staff those commissions. They come and go with the police leaders, and civilian review has a lot of limitations. And then how does the consent decree fit in this whole picture of police reform? Consent decree is, I believe, based on my research, is much more involved. It's much more extensive. It's not a temporary program or project. Somebody comes in and did something and then leave. So it's much more involved. If you really want to do it right, you must have all those areas I mentioned earlier, including the a audit function institutionalized on a permanent basis. So that will keep this program in place, keep the functions and all the positive things that supposed to come out of it, last on a long-term basis. If consent decree is lifted eventually by a federal judge, will the positive impact continue is always the question. And so the way to keep it going, to perpetuate this positive impact, is to have a institutionalized audit function in this process. And that's I think that's the key. It's much more complicated than most people realize.
Thank you so much. This has been incredibly interesting and important to understand. And I wish you well with your future research, and we will circle back to see what you've learned in a few months, maybe. We'll see what news is coming up. And we'll also see what is happening with Columbus and whether we have a consent decree.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
Bringing this back to Columbus in real time, I caught up with Sean Walton, a civil rights attorney in Columbus who has taken a leadership role in helping the community search for solutions to problems with policing in Columbus. He has represented families of victims of police violence and worked on public policy initiatives that seek racial equity in our justice system. He's on the board of the Ohio Association for Justice and the National Association for Justice. Most recently, he co-founded the Columbus Police Accountability Project.
First of all, I'd like to welcome you to this episode of The Future of Policing in Columbus. We have a lot of problems to solve here, and I know that you are very much in the thick of that. But today I want to talk about consent decrees, and I want to find out first, when did you become aware of them? They haven't been around very long.
Well, you know, first of all, thanks for having me. This is very important work that you're doing, and it's a very important conversation. For me, I think back around 2014 or 2015, when I first started really taking on civil rights cases against the Columbus Division of Police, I started to see a pattern in practice of behavior where I felt like there had to be some level of accountability for the culture that had been created over time and the constitutional violations that have existed with the Columbus Division of Police and how they police our community. And so in my work as a litigator, I began to speak with experts in police practices. And one gentleman that I spoke with was in Illinois. And he had actually served as a federal monitor for a consent decree in another city. And so we started to talk about what a consent decree looked like, how it could be used as a tool by the community in order to rectify past wrongs. And so I did research. I found that in Oakland, Oakland had a very powerful consent decree that they're, I believe, still trying to resolve their issues through that consent decree. But I saw that federal oversight, and I saw powerful civil rights attorneys that had used consent decrees in other cities to bring federal oversight to police departments that were out of control. And so I would say around 2014, 2015, I became aware. I started researching more, and I truly believed at that point that Columbus needed a consent decree in order to rectify past injustices.
At that time, were you aware that they had been approached by DOJ about 15 years before and actually didn't accept a consent decree at that point? Did that come up in your research?
It did. And it obviously stood out to me because that is something that in my research I found was very rare. I believe that Columbus was the first city to actually fight a consent decree, or the actual lawsuit that led to a consent decree. And to this day, Columbus may be the only city to fight that and to not voluntarily enter into a consent decree. So I started to see bits and pieces online, but I couldn't really find a true story as to why that happened in that way. And so I started to make calls, and I almost became an investigative reporter trying to figure out what happened. And so I started to see the backstory there and the way that Columbus negotiated their way out of that and how harmful it was in the subsequent years as a result.
As recently as a year or so ago, they were actually, they meaning the Columbus Division of Police, were actually bragging about that accomplishment on their website in Columbus.
there, you know, as the only city that has been able to get out of one. So right now, this the Columbus Division of Police has some relationship with the Department of Justice, which I understand to be sort of more of a consulting or a training partnership. Can you help us understand what's actually going on right now?
Absolutely. And so right now, the COPS division of the Department of Justice, which is the Community-Oriented Policing Services Division, they have entered into a consultation agreement with the City of Columbus. And the city has pitched it as innovative and the first of its kind, but it is really a misstep here. And it's an egregious misstep. And it's very much in line with what happened in 1999 when the DOJ filed the lawsuit, finding a pattern of racial discrimination within the Columbus Division of Police, and they fought it. Here, there was a shift in the thinking of the community, and people really realized that we cannot continue to rely on politicians to make political decisions and in a matter that is so of such grave concern to our community. And so a movement began, and the Columbus Police Accountability Project formed, of which I'm a co-founder, and we plan to ask the DOJ to come in and investigate the Columbus Division of Police and enter into a consent decree. And curiously, Mayor Ginther announced the day before our press conference, you can only imagine that word leaked out to him, that the city, that Mayor Ginther and that city attorney Zach Klein were asking the DOJ to come in, and that they had talked to the head of the COPS division and that they were asking for help. Now, the issue here is that the COPS division is generally an office that provides assistance regarding technical issues or trying to get a department up to speed in terms of 21st century policing. They'll come in and they'll help like a small town that doesn't have the resources and doesn't have the training. Now, the issue here is that over the past few years, the city of Columbus has spent millions of dollars having studies done on what's wrong with the department, having recommendations from outside consulting groups, from experts, but also from a task force that the mayor has put together. And they've already made recommendations regarding where the issues are within CDP and what needs to happen. And so COPS coming in, they're simply doing the same thing over again, but people hear federal government, they hear DOJ, and they think that something's happening. What it really is a political move in order to avoid the black eye of a consent decree, because a consent decree is not a consultation agreement. It is federal oversight. It's a mandate that a federal judge enforces. And if the division does not institute serious reforms, then there are legal measures that can come in. Now here with this COPS review, there's nothing that can happen. There's no accountability. And on top of that, I think maybe the most frustrating thing for me is that the police chief and the mayor are going to pick what they ask the COPS office to review. So it's not a DOJ investigation that would lead to a consent decree. It's not the same thing. It's nowhere near it. And in my mind, we still need to have that investigation, at least to a consent decree, and there's nothing preventing that.
So just clarifying, this is not a first step towards a consent decree, which many may think it is, or it may look like that. That the COPS program, in your perspective, is not tasked with looking for that underlying difficulties that CPD is having in conducting business, that they, in fact, if they're allowed to say, look here, don't look there, they may be able to direct the investigators away from any potential problems. Is that how you're thinking about it?
You know, that's exactly how it is going to play out. And so just for context, since this decision has been made, I've actually met with the Attorney General over the Civil Rights Division. as well as the head of the COPS division, which is, you know, a position that's under the Civil Rights Division. And so I've met with them, I've talked to them about our concerns, and they've talked to me about their process. And so I can confirm that COPS consultations are partnerships, and they do not lead to a consent decree. That's not what this is. Now, if things were to pop up that may pique the interest of the Civil Rights Division, then the COPS division can communicate that and they can, you know, look at that. But that's not the plan here. And again, the city can cherry pick and decide what gets turned over and what does not. And so if they want to avoid a consent decree, they're not going to show anything that's going to lead to an investigation that would lead to a consent decree. The goal here is to avoid a consent decree. So this is not what that is. And using the Department of Justice and the COPS division as a shield to avoid that actual investigation is doing a disservice to this community. And it is very, very similar to what happened over 20 years ago when they negotiated their way out of the consent decree.
So at the end of a normal engagement from the COPS department, which, as you said before, is usually with a smaller police department that doesn't have the kind of training and management levels that we have here, you would not expect a report to the community like, for instance, the Matrix report was, that gives us any sort of insight into what's happening. What we're expected to believe is that somehow this relationship will just generally improve things, and that we are supposed to enjoy those improvements later. Is that, that's what it feels like, what you're saying, right?
Yeah, you know, that's exactly what it is. And that's, you know, that is the extreme concern that needs to be on everyone's mind right now, is that there's no blueprint for how this plays out. There's no precedent, because typically the COPS division will advise the smaller police departments, and they'll provide certain resources if those departments don't have those resources. But Columbus has all of that. And so you're correct. We're supposed to sit back and hope that whatever they come up with is going to make an impact, when nothing they've done so far has actually made the impact that's necessary. And so that is an extreme concern. And, you know, again, there's no oversight here. It's a partnership. And so essentially, Mayor Ginther and the police department are running the consultation arrangement. You know, they're deciding what they need help with and what they, you know, want there. And so my understanding is that there's not going to be any kind of report. But if there was a report, that would be frustrating, because, as you mentioned, we have the Matrix report. We already have that. I have it on my computer. I think it's, what, 300 pages? It could be longer. But yes, it outlines the technical recommendations that are needed. You know, I've been dealing with this in the trenches since 2015. And I know that there was a task force that the governor had that was centered around 21st century policing and advancing police community relations. Nothing from that report has been implemented. I know that the Ohio Supreme Court also had a task force on grand jury reform and investigating police involved shootings. And they made a bunch of recommendations, none of which have been implemented. And so over and over again, we keep having these recommendations and these reports, but there's no enforcement and there is no accountability. And that's why we need a consent decree, because that's what happens there, is that the problems are clearly outlined. There's a plan to address those problems. And if those problems are not properly addressed, then we have accountability and we have enforcement of the agreement, and we have moves that are made to protect the citizens. We do not have that here with this COPS consultation.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the possible challenges with the consent decree. We saw during the Trump administration, when Jeff Sessions was Attorney General, that he chose not to continue oversight of these consent decrees. And for instance, there was one in place in Chicago. You mentioned Illinois earlier. The Illinois solution was to bring the oversight down to the state level and not trust the federal government given the political waverings from administration to administration. Do you think if the DOJ refuses to enter into a consent decree with Columbus that maybe there's some option at the state level?
So what I'll say is that I don't believe that the solution is at the state level. I'm involved with some lobbying efforts and other interests, at the State House. And so I understand the dynamics there. I've been involved a bit with some recommendations in terms of a police reform bill in Ohio that was first recommended, in the summer of 2020. Yes. After the protests around George Floyd. And nothing has happened with that, alleged police reform bill in this time. And so there's not really a taste for police reform at the state level. And it would kind of be playing hot potato in terms of who would have accountability here. Now, what I will go back to is the DOJ under different administrations. Now, while Jeff Sessions and the Department of Justice, they did not push any more consent decrees, my understanding is that the existing consent decrees that were already in play remained in play. And when you have a consent decree, it comes after a federal lawsuit has been filed. So you have a federal judge that oversees that. And so, we have a few more years left, at least of the Biden administration. And so if we can have an investigation, and if that investigation finds a pattern and practice of constitutional violations, then the hope would be that the city enters into a consent decree, and that regardless of what presidential administration is in place, that consent decree will still be in play because a federal judge will be overseeing it. So it may have some life, beyond that. I think the issue is that, as a new administration comes in, if there's an ongoing investigation, sometimes those investigations just stop. And that's what happened with the Trump administration. But yeah, if the ball's already rolling and it's already down on paper, that consent decree stays. And so that's truly what protects us, because on the local level, what happens if Mayor Ginther doesn't get reelected? Then we have to hope that the next mayor wants to work with the cops division in the same way or has the same vision.
Absolutely.
It's the same with Zach Klein in the city attorney's office. So what we need is a consent decree.
So thinking about the ongoing oversight that you mentioned a minute ago, I'm personally involved in reporting on the ongoing implementation of the Matrix Report and the Safety Commission, and have been able to see very little progress on either of those. What I also understand is that consent decrees can fall under the same sort of rubric of challenges, in that when the federal judge signs off eventually on all of these, checklist of reforms have been made, that things can then sort of kick back to what they used to be. And we, of course, saw that with the POER lawsuit in Columbus in the 80s. Huge number of reforms were instigated, and then we are essentially right back prior to that lawsuit. So I understand there are some cities that in their consent decrees put ongoing reform monitoring, so that a body like the Civilian Review Board or another independent review, either a commissioner or a review board, is established to make sure that not only during the time period of the consent decree, but beyond that, there is someone saying we're not falling backwards. Is that mm-hmm. something that you have seen work, or you have considered in your lobbying for a consent decree here?
Absolutely. And what is important for us to know about a consent decree is that it's not a magic pill. It's not the end all be all. And in other cities, there have been a lot of lessons learned with regard to the pros and cons of consent decrees. And so Columbus always touts itself as an innovative city and ahead of other cities around the country. And so my hope would be that we could craft a consent decree that is a holistic effect on policing in Columbus, you know, and it requires the federal government bringing in community groups, citizens, different people that have a vested interest in policing in Columbus, and working even outside of the consent decree and establishing programs that support the reforms within the consent decree and also provide for continuation, as you said, and you do need independent oversight. I mean, you know, just to sum it up for me, what a consent decree will do in Columbus is it will address all of the vast inadequacies within the current system of policing that lead to the quote unquote bad apples, you know, that we end up seeing here in Columbus. Division of Police has a lot of bad apples. And so, you know, ultimately it will kind of break down this infrastructure that is problematic and allow it to be rebuilt. And as we rebuild that, that comes in conjunction with the other things that we will holistically be looking at, you know, more counseling, you know, more mental health support, you know, things like that, that allow for officers to not be tasked with, you know, solving problems that they're not trained to solve. So absolutely, we need a holistic approach here. And the consent decree is a tool within many tools that we can use, but we need that consent decree in order to attack this system that has been pretty much indestructible and to rebuild it. And as Columbus politicians say, you know, we're reimagining policing in Columbus, and that's what the consent decree helps us do.
It's all been incredibly informative, and I'm sure most people listening didn't know even, you know, 10% of this before we started talking. What else do our listeners need to know to understand either how to help make a consent decree happen here, or how to be part, if it does happen, how to be an effective part of that process? What do citizens need to know to either educate themselves or become active in this solution?
I would say first and foremost, obviously, because the political leaders involved here are the ones who are making the decision, to hold them accountable. And obviously you can do that, you know, at the ballot on election day, at the ballot box on election day. But beyond that, you can make calls now. And, you know, if you understand the information that has been provided in this podcast and you agree that something needs to be done, then you should call and you should ask them to ask the federal government to come in and investigate. And that's what needs to happen. Not a partnership, but an investigation. Now, if that investigation leads to a clean bill of health for the Division of Police, then great. But if it doesn't, then it's the right thing to do. And it does not hurt to ask for that. And so everyone from Mayor Ginther to Zach Klein in the city attorney's office, the city council, to our US Congress people that have a say-so here, basically making calls and asking for that investigation. And you mentioned something really, really important here, and that's that the city brags about the fact that they have not entered into a consent decree. And so this decision to bring in cops is not about doing what's best for the people of this city. It is about saving face. And they bragged about that back when the settlement was first reached, I believe in 2002. The chief at the time, Chief Jackson, he actually gloated and he said that this was vindication. The settlement was vindication, that they had did nothing wrong and that they were able to go forward without that consent decree. But he literally said that it was vindicating and that they did nothing wrong. And that completely flies in the face of the fact that the federal Department of Justice investigated. That investigation began in, I think, 1997 or 98, culminating in a lawsuit in 1999, and the city negotiated with them and fought it until 2002. And they still claim no wrongdoing, and that shines a light on why, for the next 20 years, we've had a continued deterioration of the police-community relationship in Columbus, because it's just, it's they do not accept responsibility. So we have to call them to task here. We have to push for a consent decree because we do not want to be sitting here another, 20 years from now trying to figure out what needs to happen. This needs to happen now.
Wonderful talking to you today. I thank you so much for your time. And I do hope we'll talk again sometime soon. So thank you so much.
Thank you for your work as well.
Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to The Future of Policing in Columbus with Edie Driscoll. My guests today were Dr. Susan Smith from Faith and Public Life, Dr. Alan Zhao from Rowan University, and attorney Sean Walton from the Columbus Police Accountability Project. You can check out our other episodes at matternews.org and at WCBE Podcast Experience or anywhere you get your podcasts.
Why you keeping me down? Why you crossing the line? Why you crossing the line? I'm just raising my voice. Why you keeping me down?